Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the Cold War really end, and what did its conclusion mean for the stature of the United States in the world? While many Americans, average citizens, and national leaders alike tend to see the end of the Cold War as a victory for our side, a key player in its peaceful resolution says the reality is far more complex and that we misunderstand or ignore the truth to our peril. Jack F. Matlock Jr. served a total of 35 years in the U.S. Foreign Service, including as the U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union at the very end of the Cold War. His new book is called Superpower Illusions: How Myths and False Ideologies Led America Astray and How to Return to Reality. Jack, welcome to Think.
I'm delighted to be with you.
You presented your credentials as U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union in 1987. That had to be an extremely exciting time. Will you talk for just a minute about the state of U.S.-Soviet relations at that particular moment in history?
Well, you know, in the spring of 87, when I went as ambassador, we were beginning to see some real movement in U.S.-Soviet relations because Gorbachev had begun to talk about reforms and had begun to talk seriously about the sort of major reductions in nuclear weapons that we thought was so important. He had also accepted the idea of on-site inspection, which his predecessors had never agreed to. So we were very cautiously optimistic in April when I went to Moscow as ambassador. Of course, I had been on the NSC staff in the Reagan administration and was President Reagan's principal advisor on Soviet affairs. So I was quite aware when I went that of what our programs were, and I began to see the possibility of change in the Soviet Union. And so it was exciting to go and to, might say, test the possibilities, see how far Gorbachev's reforms would go. Were they for real? We were still debating that. How deep would they go? Would he be removed if he went too fast? There were so many questions, and I would say certainly it was the most exciting time of my life to be there on the spot when these things were going on.
What sort of approach did President Reagan apply to the task of repairing those long-standing animosities between the Soviet bloc and the Democratic West?
You know, he set forth a four-part agenda for us to deal with the issues. And that agenda was set forth as goals for cooperation. He didn't say, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. Well, obviously, they had to make some major changes.
As did we, though.
But what he said was, let's cooperate to reduce arms, particularly nuclear weapons, to the lowest possible levels. Let's cooperate to remove support for wars in the third world. Let's cooperate to improve human rights observance, and let's build a better working relationship. Now that was a euphemism for saying let's tear down that Iron Curtain. And so, in those four areas, he concentrated his attention.
But the idea of cooperation is really no small thing here, because it also signified the fact that we were willing to make some concessions and that both sides could potentially benefit from ending this.
That's absolutely right. And he would make that point. When he was sometimes accused of asking too much, he would say publicly, look, when I was negotiating for the studios, he was president of the Screen Actors Guild, we always ask for more than we would settle for. I understand negotiation. But I think his willingness to continue negotiations regardless of what would happen. You know, we would have these periodic crises when a Korean airliner was shot down or when an American officer was killed in East Germany. And there were people in the administration who would say, you know, we got to stop negotiation until they apologize, et cetera. And Reagan would say, no, you know, this is the time you need to keep your communication going. And, of course, we don't want these things to happen again. We want insurances against it. But we'll be able to deal with it only if we keep negotiating. and we don't walk away from negotiating tables. He was never one to feel that we were penalizing the Soviets when we refused to talk to them.
Another interesting aspect of your career that people may not realize is that you were working as a translator during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes, that's right. I translated, with the help of one of my colleagues, the Khrushchev's messages to Kennedy. This was during my first tour in Moscow.
And it must have been a remarkable evolution to, and obviously you were part of that evolution, but you know, to go from that to the moment when the Cold War was about to end.
Yes, well, it was, and it was particularly exciting for a person after, like myself. I had been mainly a specialist in Soviet internal affairs. My graduate work was in Russian literature, Russian language, and I learned enough of several other Soviet languages to be able to read speeches or to read them. And so I think those of us who really looked closely at the internal affairs were better able to assess the possibilities of change than those who looked exclusively at what the Soviets were doing abroad. Because after all, there, like everywhere else, the foreign policy really stems from internal policy. And to understand what is happening, you've really got to understand what's happening inside the country.
Yeah, you remind us here that foreign policy and domestic policy shape each other at both the best and the worst times in history.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And this is true of us, and it's true of others. And the conjunction of internal and external policy is so obvious, and yet so often people ignore that. It's almost as if foreign policy is in one category and domestic policy in another. And usually we're organized so the president will have a foreign policy advisor, a domestic policy advisor, and yet often the two are so intertwined that it's very hard to separate them.
I think a really striking notion for me in reading this book, I come away with this idea that the Cold War was not like a hot war. It was, in fact, a metaphor in the same way that we talk about the war on drugs or the war on poverty. And we don't now, when we look back on it, think of it as a metaphor.
Well, this is one of the problems in calling it a war. Because then people talk about almost any challenge as being a war. And I think, as I say in the book, if you're going to use that metaphor to say we've got to make unusual sacrifices in order to deal with this problem, then maybe it's appropriate. But I thought in the case of the Iraq War, when, you know, we were not asked to make any sacrifices other than the people in our armed forces, we're not even asked to pay the taxes to pay for it, or the war on terror, as we spoke, which is also a metaphor, because it's not directly related to what you put in the armed forces, and yet to call it a war and then not call for the sacrifices to wage the war, I find quite misplaced. And we got into the habit with the Cold War of calling almost any major effort a war. And we really need to understand that there is a difference in war between countries and competition between countries, and there's certainly a difference in war between countries and defending yourself from terrorism. That has military aspects, but at heart, it's not the same.
What assumptions did we Americans start to make regarding our own post-Soviet stature in the world?
Well, I think we were led to believe, and in fact it was almost a universal feeling, that we were the sole superpower. And therefore, we could do anything we wished, and that we had enough power really to change relationships in the world if we just would apply our military power, which was unchallenged, of course. What people missed was that our influence, our real power, which is much more than military power, it involves economic power, it involves what one calls soft power, the power to persuade, that diminished at the end of the Cold War, because during the Cold War, we could keep very faithful allies because we were able to protect them from communism. Now, when there was no threat from communism, people didn't need us often to protect them. So then if we start getting involved in wars that don't involve us directly, as we did in the Balkans and as we did elsewhere in the 90s, we tend to make enemies without really defending ourselves. And yet much of this was done, the feeling that there was a what they called a unipolar world, that is, only one country counted. Now, there are a lot of problems with that. One, the whole idea that the two superpowers during the Cold War ran the world. We didn't. And many of the things that happened in the world happened totally irrelevant to the Cold War. And the idea that somehow you had two powers that were running everything and then the Soviet Union collapses so only one is left, they forget that by ending the Cold War and ending that confrontation, and when there was no threat from communism, the United States became less powerful, not more. And yet by overextending, by promising more and trying to do more than we could do, we have gotten ourselves terribly overextended in the world, in my opinion.
And essentially, the Soviet Union failed not because we were bigger and stronger and fought harder, but because, in your characterization, Soviet leaders saw the world in ideological terms as opposed to realistic terms.
That's right. This was the fundamental problem. And, you know, three things happened that that many people think of as one. Three things happened between the late 80s and the early 90s. One was the end of the Cold War, and the Cold War ended well before the Soviet Union collapsed. And it ended as a negotiated end. And actually, it was advantageous to the Soviet Union to end it because we ended the arms race that was killing them economically. Second, you had a weakening of communist control in the Soviet Union. That happened not because we brought pressure on them, but because the pressure, external pressure, was released at the end of the Cold War, and it gave Gorbachev an attempt to reform the country internally. And it was Gorbachev, the leader of the Communist Party, that weakened it. And then the Soviet Union broke up at the end of 1991 because of internal pressures. Now, it would not have broken up if we still had the Cold War, because the Cold War was acting like the, you know, the lid and of a pressure cooker by keeping the pressures in. When we relieved that and there was no pressure, and then the internal contradictions within the communist system pushed it apart. So the people's idea that we brought down communism is the opposite of the truth. It brought itself down. And we facilitated it getting down by helping them end the Cold War on terms that were advantageous to both sides. So, you know, this is at the core of much of the misunderstanding that I describe in the book.
My guest this hour is Jack F. Matlock, Jr., former U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union. His new book is called Superpower Illusions, How Myths and False Ideologies Led America Astray and How to Return to Reality. You can join the conversation right now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former U.S. Ambassador to the Soviet Union, Jack F. Matlock Jr. His new book is called Superpower Illusions, How Myths and False Ideologies Led America Astray and How to Return to Reality. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Jack, you mentioned earlier the Balkans, and one of the concerns you have about what happened in the Clinton administration is that we started getting ourselves involved in regional conflicts that really didn't apply directly to the security of the United States. That is a concern for you. We also get a picture of Bill Clinton really dropping the ball here in seizing this momentous opportunity for positive change in the world after the Cold War.
Yes. You know, I think our strategy should have been to try to encourage the Europeans, once the Cold War was over, to organize themselves to take care of the security in their own continent. And that would have involved bringing together with Russia, encouraging a democratic development in Russia, making them full partners, because Russia still has considerable influence in the Balkans, and they could have influenced the Serbs. Instead, the mistake to start expanding NATO to the east, which I and many others argued against at the time, really made it virtually impossible for the Russians to see that it was in their interest to be a full partner in European security. And then later, when over Kosovo, we made war against Serbia. After all, we bombed Serbia without any authorization from the UN over these human rights problems. Now, obviously, one needed to do something about issues like Bosnia and Kosovo to avoid violence. But a different diplomacy, a different approach by the United States, I think would have been much more advantageous to everybody than the approach that we took. But in the final analysis, one of the lessons others drew from the way we treated the Balkans was that if you're going to get in trouble with the United States, you better get nuclear weapons. Because everybody knew we would not have bombed Serbia if Serbia had nuclear weapons. So you had an intensification of the programs in North Korea and Iran. Also, at that time, India and Pakistan went nuclear. So this had implications for non-proliferation and other things.
So we start to see a sort of chipping away at the power of international law that many people would argue reached its zenith after 9/11 when the United States went into Iraq.
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, it really, I think, was unacceptable for a military alliance to make war against a country which had not attacked it. And that's what happened in the case of the bombing of Serbia. Serbia... there were potential atrocities in Kosovo, which one had to deal with. But if there was to be military intervention, it should have been authorized by the United Nations. And a different diplomacy earlier would probably have allowed us to get a vote, including Russia and China, in the United Nations. When we couldn't, we said, all right, NATO can make this decision. Now, we would never accept a military alliance making decisions of war and peace bypassing the UN. We would say that's unacceptable if other people were doing it to us or to our allies. And yet we seem to try to simply avoid the principles which the United States had taken the lead in building earlier. And I attribute part of this to the assumption that we were all-powerful, and we didn't really need allies or, for that matter, international law to defend our interests. And I think that was a great era.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking this hour about the new book Superpower Illusions with its author Jack F. Matlock, Jr. Let's go to Thomas in Dallas. Hello, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah. You know, we have what we call the good German phenomenon, which refers, of course, to Nazi Germany. And we're told that happened in the Soviet Union, where what you're saying, ideology or whatever, other motives drove the discussion and the people were subjected to another propaganda. And I dare say we're seeing that now. I mean, few people in the media will discuss that Georgia was the aggressor in the recent deal there and that we kind of got pantsed in that whole endeavor. You know, NATO stands as a treaty that against Russia, and that's problematic. We keep expanding that. And it's just the policymakers, the media, everybody's talking about Aminajad's bellicose claims. All these things are not real, but they stand as real here and for our debate. And is that a comment to this dissolution of empires?
Well, I do comment on these issues in the book. And I think one of our problems is that we tend to debate many of these issues as if they were liberal or conservative dichotomy. And actually, in most of the cases, it's not a case of liberalism or conservatism. You've got to be more pragmatic about what is happening. And one of the problems with so much of our debate, particularly in the last 8 years, and particularly since 9/11, has been the tendency to, I would say, to demonize whole groups of people, and instead of looking at the real facts of the matter. And by our refusal to talk to enemies or potential enemies, which had been the case for a long time with Iran, and at times with North Korea, has actually helped people like Ahmadinejad come to power. We had openings that we passed up to deal with the Iranians and said, you know, in effect, you've got to do what we say or we don't talk. Now, this was the opposite of our policy with the Soviet Union back when we solved the Cold War. So I'm not saying that these countries are not a threat. They are. Nor am I saying that we are to blame. But at the same time, by attempting to use the wrong methods, we actually have been, I think, encouraging these rogue regimes to act in an irresponsible way. And there must be a better way to go about it. And I think if we approach them the way we approached the end of the Cold War and the Reagan and the first Bush administration, we would have a better chance of heading off confrontations before they occur.
If I may quote briefly from the book here, you write, "There is nothing conservative about invading a country that has not attacked you, and nothing liberal about devastating another country in the belief that doing so will promote democracy. There is nothing conservative about huge budget deficits, and nothing liberal about putting up barriers to trade." Can you talk for a minute about why pragmatism has gotten such a black eye in terms of political discourse in this country in the past decade or two?
You know, I think that the polarization of our politics, which those are the old-timers like myself, we can remember when we had a bipartisan foreign policy. And, you know, the parties might argue on who's being more effective than the other. But basically, during most of the Cold War, we had a bipartisan foreign policy. And you could, you know, one administration, whether Republican or Democrat, could deal with a Congress, often dominated by the other party, to get real things done. Now, from the 90s, and you can almost time it with the 94 election, when the Republicans took over with Newt Gingrich's leadership, you basically, from then on, seem to have had just a total lack of communication. And everything seems to become just black and white and arguing in imagery and slogans which don't really fit the facts. And that's what worries me about the current situation. You see the sort of arguments that that are used often in public. It makes everything a zero-sum game when life is not like that. And so I worry about the fact that our politics has become so, so separate that, that it's almost impossible to find a middle ground.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Patrick in Richardson. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. Ambassador Matlock, if I may say, or dare say, old-timer, you sure know what you're talking about. That was such an interesting dissection and discourse on the beginnings of the Serbian conflict. It was really fascinating. I just have a – heard a story a long time ago about how in the embassy in Russia – we found a listening device that was placed in the seal of America behind or in a conference room, and it was a contraption that had no moving parts. We didn't know how it worked, and we nicknamed it the Thing, but it just showcased how at the end of the Cold War, you know, even enemies still pay attention to each other, even when times of non-antagonism. I'll take my question off the air, and just great show again.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, on that, you know, I would say now that I don't have to worry about divulging classified information, that both sides tried to, both of us tried to bug the other side and find out as much as we could. And I'm not sure that one was any better or any more or less competent than the other in that respect. The public made much more of it, and in the United States, it was as if only the Soviets tried bugging. And, of course, we didn't talk about the other side, but, in fact, both of us tried to find out as much as we could about the other, as I think we should have done.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
I hate to belabor the point. I'm really, just like everybody else, we're all enjoying the clarity that you bring to this discussion. I was going to ask, I had a question, but I think he's answered it already, so I'm going to change my question slightly. Who do you go to for clarity? I'm really curious to know the answer to this. If people go to you for clarity, is it Bill Moyers, you know, the writer Andrew Bacevich? Heck, and maybe Bill O'Reilly? Who do you feel is adding something to this discussion rather than just simply injecting disinformation into the process? Thank you very much, and great show.
Thanks for your call.
You know, I don't spend a lot of time looking at television, and quite honestly, I'm put off by the shouting heads, I certainly wouldn't go to O'Reilly. And I really think that one of the problems is not so much the personalities of the people, but what seems to be the short time span or attention span of much of the American public. You just don't take time to learn the ins and outs. And often, you know, both God and the devil are in the details. And if we think in imagery and that imagery is misplaced or doesn't fit, we're going to make some pretty bad decisions. So I think in part just the fact that so much of our information does come from sound bites is one of our problems, because most of these issues cannot really be understood as a series of sound bites or as a series of generalities. And I don't know how we get back, if we ever were there, to a fuller, you know, discussion of the ins and outs. But we certainly need more of that in our politics, and particularly we need more, I would say, willingness to listen to what the other side is saying without just calling a bunch of names or labeling everything either conservative or liberal, you know, without really understanding what we're talking about.
Jack, I think it's safe to say that Americans breathed a collective sigh of relief after the end of the Cold War, feeling suddenly quite secure in the world. How did that blind us to the fact that there was a growing threat of Islamic terrorism on the horizon?
You know, I think that, frankly, I think it was understood in the government there was a growing threat of terrorism. I don't think anybody would have thought that an American administration would have been so I would say, negligent as the Bush-Cheney administration was when they were warned and did nothing to prevent hijackings. I mean, this has been one of the most incredible failures of leadership, because there was enough information to, when there were warnings that Al-Qaeda was planning an attack in the United States. You know, if you were ask any expert to give me three or four things they might do, one of the it's hijacking aircraft to fly into planes would have certainly been on that list. And would that have been hard to stop? No. All you have to do is change the instructions to pilots. And the instructions to pilots were, if you are hijacked, do what the hijacker says. The assumption was the hijacker is going to, just wants to fly somewhere else, and you need to save the passengers. Well, there had not been a hijacking like that for over 10 years. Therefore, instructions of that sort immediately, understanding that if there is a hijacking, this time it's going to be to fly into a building, a suicide mission. Therefore, the last thing you do is give the hijackers control. Those orders were not given. If they had been, they would have had to abort the whole operation. So, you know, looking back, and I think this is a point that largely for political reasons, the 9/11 Commission didn't put the finger on it, but I describe in my book my own feeling and with my own knowledge of in the past of how information is passed and often not passed in the federal government. It really was the responsibility of the president, the vice president, and the national security advisor to see to it that the bureaucracy did what it was supposed to do when they got warning, but they didn't. And I think after that, psychologically, the Bush-Cheney administration had to, in effect, sell the idea that the world changed. Of course, the world didn't change. And when you look back, you find out that you know, in December 31st, 1999, as we're turning over to the year 2000, the top of the Clinton administration, the National Security Advisor, others, were going around the clock checking on all the possibilities of terrorism that might occur at that time.
Let me stop you right there. We have to take a quick break. Jack F. Matlock is my guest. The new book is called Superpower Illusion.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jack F. Matlock, Jr. He is former U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union with a 35-year career in the Foreign Service. His new book is called Superpower Illusions, How Myths and False Ideologies Led America Astray and How to Return to Reality. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can reach us via email to think@kera.org. Jack, of all of his recent predecessors in modern history, you believe that President Obama most resembles Ronald Reagan. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. You know, obviously, there are differences in their approach, there are differences in their philosophy. But from the standpoint of leadership, from the standpoint of how they deal with people, how, and particularly the philosophy regarding our how one deals with international affairs. President Reagan was a true believer in moving toward the total elimination of nuclear weapons. He believed that with a passion. And that was what allowed him eventually to bond with Gorbachev, who was convinced of the same thing. He understood that nuclear weapons are a threat in and of themselves. And they're a threat to mankind. It is too much power for a human being to be able to unleash, too much destructive power. I mean, we can destroy life on the planet, and we need to find a way to deal with that. I would say of all the decisions that President Obama made, and made even during the campaign, was his endorsement of this principle, and he has changed policies in it. And his endorsement of the proposal that former Secretary of State George Shultz, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and Senator Sam Nunn, Bill Perry, former Secretary of Defense, Republicans and Democrats have made on this issue, this has impressed me, because both the Clinton administration and the Bush-Cheney administration seem to have forgotten this issue, which is really, I think, right at the top of any list of security interests of the United States. But also, how do you solve things? You solve things by talking to people, by dealing with them with respect. I mean, it doesn't mean that you're soft at all. You need to negotiate, but you need to negotiate from strength, and you need to understand what strength is. And Reagan did. He never thought of strength as just military power, and nor military plus economic power. Strength is also political, in that you have the support of your people, or the ability to get it, to do what you need to do. So the way they operate, the way you can listen to everybody, as Reagan did, and at the same time not deal with people whom you disagree with as enemies. That was one of the problems that President Nixon had, his enemies list. Whereas Reagan never considered the peace movement, which opposed some of the things he thought were necessary, as enemies. He said, we have the same ends, but, you know, I think to get there, if we're going to eliminate these weapons, we've got to convince Gorbachev he can't win an arms race. And that was the reason for his buildup. It was not to attack the Soviet Union. It was to show the other side that they have an interest in reducing these and eventually getting rid of them. So it's the manner that they deal with the questions, the manner they deal with other people, and the philosophy where you put your priority and the philosophy of how you deal with others. That's what reminds me. And both were eloquent in carrying the message to the American people. And that's another aspect that I thought was very important. With all the differences in personality, these are the things that I find similar.
Yeah, you write, ultimately, President Obama's ability to bring about the changes America needs will depend on the American public's resistance to the false myths and false ideologies that led both the Clinton administration and, to a much greater degree, the Bush-Cheney administration astray. Is that within the president's power to sort of change to cause Americans not to latch on to things that aren't true?
Well, obviously, he can't do it alone.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he can't do anything alone. No American president can. He's got to have enough support from Congress to get it done, and Congress is going to have enough support of the American people so that they're not constantly being, I would say, distracted by what are either false or irrelevant arguments. And unfortunately, as we mentioned before, this confrontational style in our current politics makes it extraordinarily difficult. I might just say, in connection with that, I thought that President Obama fully deserved the Peace Prize because he changed the whole thrust and direction of American policy. Whether he can bring about peace and achieve the goals will depend on other people. And, you know, that's going to be difficult. And as I point out in my book, no administration is going to be totally uniform. There are plenty of people in his administration in key positions that differ from me in their assessment of what we need to do. And I would hope that the qualities that he has will lead us through. I do feel we, in almost every area, have a different direction now than we had, say, 2 years ago. And I think that is a very important change.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi, dear. My question has to do with the Kennedy assassination. A lot of people thought at that time that the search for detente that was going on in his administration was a possible cause for the assassination. And I was just curious as to what effect this had on the Soviet Union, especially given the fact that we were just past the Bay of Pigs at that point.
In the Kennedy, I don't think the assassination had anything really to do with the Cold War. As a consular officer, I had met Lee Harvey Oswald before he went back to the United States because he had not lost his American citizenship. Therefore, he had a right to come back. It was very clear to us who dealt with him. He was an extraordinarily difficult person. He was not one that was run by the KGB or by anybody else, in my opinion. I think he had a Napoleonic complex, and, you know, obviously it didn't occur to any of us in advance. I actually issued his wife's visa so that, you know, he could bring his family back to the States. It didn't occur to any of us that, you know, he was capable of assassinating the president. But I must say that I was overseas when the assassination occurred, and when I heard that Lee Harvey Oswald had been arrested, my wife turned to me and said, "Jack, isn't that?" And I said, "My God, yes." Mm-hmm. And, you know, he could have done it. It suddenly clicked, the sort of personality, and I've never doubted, and I've read the Warren Commission report and many of the books and things, I've never doubted that he was a lone assassin. So I wouldn't put Kennedy's assassination in the Cold War context.
You write that it's important that we have a Plan C for Afghanistan, which will involve regional cooperation on fixing the situation there if there's no improvement by the end of this year. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, I would say that I understand that given the stance President Obama took during the campaign, which I think was correct, that we had diverted attention from Afghanistan and went unnecessarily to Iraq, and therefore we had to return attention to Afghanistan. I think that his approval of putting more troops in was probably necessary politically. But the fact is, we are facing a developing situation in Afghanistan that may be unwinnable. And I think what we have to start thinking of, and I'm sure people have already started thinking of it, aren't there ways you can separate al-Qaeda from the Taliban, and number one, and concentrate on al-Qaeda? And though none of us want the Taliban to come back and control Afghanistan, if that separation can occur, it's going to be no threat to us. And eventually, the Afghans are going to have to take care of themselves in that respect. We can't occupy that country forever. We're not going to. And to imply that we're going to stay, you know, forever, I think is the wrong message. So I think President Obama essentially made the only choice that was politically viable at this time, because leaving it like it was wasn't going to work. You can't just not put in more troops and build schools, as some people have said, because they're going to destroy the schools if you don't have enough troops for security. I think that we clearly need a new strategy, and if by later this year it clearly isn't working, I think we have to think of ways that we can leave without creating again a base for al-Qaeda. And I believe that's possible. I pointed out, for example, we should be able virtually to quarantine the area in terms of movement in and out, at least know if people go in, come out. And we can see from what's happening in Yemen that al-Qaeda is not dependent on any one base. The problem is there are a lot of different places they can plan things from. Particularly small operations like a given person, like the Christmas would-be bomber. To think that you have to wipe them out totally, I think, is probably unrealistic. But we do need, if the current surge, as we might call it, doesn't work, is not clearly working, then I do think we have to find another way to deal with it.
When you were sitting in your office in 1991, would you have imagined that the world would forget the lessons of the Cold War as quickly as they had and as thoroughly as we have?
No, absolutely not. Among other things, it would have never occurred to me that once Europe was united, that anybody would think that it was a good idea to expand NATO to the east and taking in the East European countries. We needed a new security system in, you know, for Europe and for the world to replace the one during the Cold War. So, no, a lot of things that happened in the 90s I could not have imagined in 91.
What do you think is the most important thing that President Obama can do to sort of prove to you that he understands those lessons and will act accordingly?
Well, I think he does understand the lessons. But I think his problem is that, you know, we have talked before about domestic and foreign policy being so interconnected. The problem is, with the sort of divisions we have, when he needs 60 votes in the Senate to get health care through, or, for that matter, regulation of the financial community, or if we need another stimulus package, given the confrontations that have occurred and the unwillingness of any substantial number of Republicans to cooperate, you know, almost any individual senator can hold up action that changes in one of his favorite fields. I think, for example, President Obama does understand what needs to be done in the Middle East to further a real peace between Israel and the Palestinians. But I think the political situation in the United States right now makes it impossible to do it. So this, I think, is his problem, not a lack of understanding, but an inability, given the, I would say, the positions that people in both parties have taken to change some very important things.
Jack F. Matlock, Jr. served a total of 35 years in the U.S. Foreign Service, including as U.S. Ambassador to the Soviet Union from 1987 until 1991. His new book is called Superpower Illusions: How Myths and False Ideologies Led America Astray and How to Return to Reality. Jack, thank you so much for spending
the
hour
with us. And thank you, Chris. It's been a great program, and I appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.